characters, elementary strings, etc. So what I plan to do in these two lectures is the following. In the first lecture, I'll try to develop some general techniques for studying entropy of extremal black holes. In gravity coupled to matter with higher derivative terms. At this stage, I'll not talk specifically about string theory, but try to generally work with gravity with higher derivative terms. In the second lecture, I'll apply the results of whatever results I'll be deriving in the first lecture to the study of the correspondence between elementary strings and black holes in string theory, the subject that Samir Mathur discussed in quite a great detail. And the main reference for this lecture will be this one and all the other relevant references you can find in this. There is also a related but somewhat complementary work by Krauss and Larsen in this paper. So let me start with a brief motivation for why we want to study gravity coupled to matter fields with higher derivative interaction. As you all know, string theory contains gravity, but it also contains other matter fields like scalars, gauge fields, etc. And the low energy dynamics of string theory is described by an effective action which has two derivative terms. And here are some examples of two derivative terms that you can think of. This, for example, is the standard Einstein-Hilbert action. This R is the scalar curvature, which has two derivatives. This is the standard kinetic term for a scalar field. Again, as you can see, it has two derivatives. This is the standard kinetic term for gauge fields. Again, it has two derivatives because F mu is constructed out of a single derivative of a gauge field. But when you try to construct the full effective action of string theory, even if you don't talk about loop corrections, even if you want to restrict yourselves to string tree level, just the alpha prime corrections gives rise to an infinite set of higher derivative terms. And here is one specific example of a higher derivative term that typically arises in string theory, namely the square of the Riemann tensor. It contains four derivatives because each Riemann tensor is constructed out of two derivatives. So if we want to study black holes in string theory, it is clear that what you want to do is to study black holes in higher derivative theories of gravity plus matter fields, a specific higher derivative theory that comes from string theory. But for the time being, we will not make a restriction as to which kind of higher derivative theory we will be considering. Now, we have also heard about Hawking radiation a lot in this school. So what we know is that typically all black holes Hawking radiate, and hence they are unstable because they continuously lose mass by Hawking radiation. But there is a special class of black holes for which the Hawking temperature is zero. And so at least in the semi-classical approximation, these black holes are stable. And these are known as extremal black holes. And in our study, we'll be focusing on only on the extremal black holes, because since these are the stable objects, one expects that it should be easier to study these objects rather than a general black hole, which is unstable. So the goal then will be to analyze extremal black holes in higher derivative gravity in d dimensions, where d can be arbitrary, because although the complete string theory lives in 10 dimensions, or to work with M theory, you live in 11 dimensions, we can always compactify some number of dimensions, 10 minus d dimensions, and consider an effective theory which lives in d dimensions. So generically, we would like to study black holes in d dimensions. And if we want to focus on stable black holes, then you would like to study extremal black holes in d dimensions. And because you are dealing with string theory, we have to take into account high derivative interactions. And in this discussion, we should be we'll be restricting ourselves to spherically symmetric black holes. Although there are known examples of stable black holes which are not spherically symmetric in higher dimension. Are there any questions up to this point? Now, mostly we deal with supersymmetric string theory, and we deal with BPS black holes, which means black holes which preserve half the supersymmetry. But in our analysis, at least for this lecture, we will not assume that the theory is supersymmetric. There are two reasons for this. The first reason is that we want to be as general as possible. We want to see how much we can say without assuming supersymmetry. This is not only relevant for studying non-supersymmetric string theories, but also in the context of supersymmetric string theories, one would like to understand how much, what feature of the black holes is dependent on supersymmetry and what features are more general. So we want to keep the analysis as general as possible, and because of this, we will not assume that the theory is supersymmetric. There is also a practical reason why we don't want to use supersymmetry, and that's due to the fact that in general, it is extremely difficult to supersymmetrize higher derivative terms. So if you want to include a certain set of higher derivative terms in string theory, and you want to supersymmetrize them, there is no known method which can be applied in general, although people have succeeded in supersymmetrizing a certain class of higher derivative terms that I'll talk about in the next lecture. So even if the theory is supersymmetric, we may not always be able to use it effectively to our advantage. Okay, so even if you have a BPS black hole in a supersymmetric string theory, we may still not be able to use supersymmetry. And so it's good to ask how much can we say without making use of supersymmetry explicitly. Now, because we don't use supersymmetry, we are at a slight disadvantage because now we have to decide how to define what an extremal black hole is. Normally, in a supersymmetric theory, one can define extremal black holes as BPS black holes which are invariant under a subset of the supersymmetric transformations. But if you are not willing to use supersymmetry, or if your theory, if the theory that we are dealing with is not supersymmetric, then we cannot use BPS condition to define extremal black holes. Okay, so you have to look for some other mechanism. So the question then will be, how do we recognize extremal black holes in a higher derivative theory? And here, we'll try to take a clue from the usual supergravity. We'll study extremal black hole solutions in usual gravity and supergravity, study what specific features they have, and those are the features that we'll be using to define what we mean by extremal black hole in a higher derivative theory of gravity, which do not necessarily have supersymmetry. Okay, are there any questions? So just for simplicity, we will be doing most of our analysis in the t equal to 4 case. And at the end, I'll try to discuss its generalization to higher dimension if I have time. So let's begin with d equal to 4 case. And in d equal to 4, if you are looking at spherically symmetric black holes, we know examples of extremal black hole solutions. These are extremal black hole solutions which carry electric charge or magnetic charge. And these solutions are known as Reisner-Nordström solutions. So a typical Reisner-Nordström solution in 4 dimensions has this form. You can see that the coefficients of dt square has a function that has a double zero, that has a zero at the value rho equal to rho plus, rho being the radial coordinate, and also at rho equal to rho minus. And the corresponding coefficients of d rho squared has poles at rho equal to rho plus and rho equal to rho minus. This is unlike Schwarzschild solutions, which has a single zero and a single pole here. And then, of course, there is the usual sphere part, which comes along for the ride. Now, in this case, the extremal limit of the black hole corresponds to changing the parameters. By the way, I should have said that this rho plus and rho minus are themselves determined in terms of the mass and charge of the black hole. So the extremal limit corresponds to adjusting the parameters, the mass and the charge of the black hole, in such a way that rho plus and rho minus become equal to each other. So let's set rho plus equal to rho minus and try to simplify this solution. And we'll simplify it by looking at the solution near the horizon. Okay, horizon, I should have said, is at rho minus and rho plus. So you set rho plus equal to rho minus and see how the solution behaves near the horizon. And to do that, it's useful to define some rescale and redefine variables. So I'll define a variable tau, a new time variable, which is simply a rescaling of t. And I'll define a new radial variable r, which is just rho minus rho plus. And I look at the metric near r equal to 0, okay, namely near rho equal to rho plus. And in this case, the metric takes this form. Okay. This is, in fact, a familiar form. This metric is known as the metric on ADS2 times S2. This part describes an ADS2 space, two-dimensional anti-de Sitter metric. And this part defines a two-dimensional sphere. The coefficients in front are the sizes of ADS2 and S2. These determine how strongly carved the ADS2 space and the S2 space are. And in this specific example that I have discussed, the ADS2 and S2 have the same size, as you can see, because it's the same rho plus which appears in front of both metrics. So what we learn from here is that if we take an extremal Reisner-Nordström solution in four dimensions, then the near horizon geometry of this solution is ADS2 times S2. In fact, it turns out that all known extremal black holes in four dimensions with non-singular near horizon geometry have near horizon geometry ADS2 times S2. Okay, so in all known examples, the near horizon geometry of an extremal black hole turns out to be ADS2 times S2. And these examples include some examples which where we not only deal with the two derivative terms in the action, but also include a subset of the higher derivative corrections. Okay, so even after including higher derivative corrections, often we find that, in fact, all known examples, we find that the geometry, the near horizon geometry of the extremal black hole is ADS2 times S2. And from these examples, we learn a lesson. And the lesson is that we can take the definition of extremal black hole as the one whose near horizon geometry is given by ADS2 times S2. In other words, even if you are dealing with a theory of higher derivative gravity, where you don't know explicitly perhaps how to construct a full black hole solution, we will define a black hole to be extremal if its near horizon geometry is ADS2 times S2. So now let me be a little bit more specific. The theory that we'll be dealing with in four dimensions is a general gauge and general coordinate invariant theory, which is described by a set of variables, the metric g mu nu, gauge fields, which will denote by a mu I. Here I, this index I, labels more than one gauge fields. In general, you can have n gauge fields. But I should have said these are all abelian gauge fields. OK, I'll be only considering abelian gauge fields. And a set of scalars, phi s, which are neutral under these abelian gauge fields. I'll not make any specific assumption of what kind of action we have except that the axon is general coordinate invariant. It's gauge invariant. But it can contain arbitrary higher derivative terms involving the metric, the gauge field strengths, the scalar fields, and so on. In this theory, I'll define an extremal black hole to have the following property. First of all, I will define that it should have near horizon geometry ADS 2 times S2. But once the near horizon geometry is given by ADS 2 times S2, we see that this geometry has a large symmetric group, because S2, for example, has a symmetric group, SO3. Okay, the metric on S2 is invariant under an SO3 symmetric group. Similarly, the metric on ADS2 is invariant under an SO2,1 symmetric group. I'll further assume that all other background fields, namely the scalar field phi s, the gauge fields f mu nu, respect this SO2,1 times SO3 symmetry of ADS2 times S2. So I'll define an extremal black hole to be the one which is described by a background that is invariant under the SO2,1 times SO3 symmetric group. And again, this is a feature of all known spherically symmetric extremal black hole solutions that we know in four dimensions. Yeah, I think you can do that. And I have a suspicion that probably will lead eventually to this same criteria. Yeah. Yes, there is. I'll discuss that. Okay, in fact, the obvious generalization to higher dimension is that the spherically symmetric extremal black holes will have ADS 2 times SD minus 2 geometry. And the symmetric group will be SO2,1 times SOD minus 1. But I'll discuss this explicitly later. Okay, are there any other questions? So with this criteria, we can now write down the most general form of the near horizon geometry of an extremal black hole. And here it is. The metric is given by an ADS2 factor with an arbitrary size V1. Okay, we no longer require that the size of ADS2 and size of S2 must be the same. So the metric is given by an ADS2 metric with arbitrary size V1, and an S2 metric with arbitrary size V2. The requirement of SO2,1 times SO3 invariance restricts this scalar field phi s to be constants. It cannot, one can easily check that the scalar field cannot depend on the coordinates of ADS2 or S2. It's easy to see for S2, right? If you want a scalar field configuration on a sphere that is invariant under full SO3 rotation group, okay, the only possible configuration is where the scalar field is constant on the sphere. And the same analysis generalizes to ADS2. Okay, because after all, ADS2 you can get from S2 by some analytic configuration. The gauge field, the form of the gauge fields are also restricted by the requirement of the SO3 times SO2,1 symmetry. And what one can check is that the RT component of the gauge fields must be constants. Okay, so Fi RT must be equal to EI, where EIs are some constants. And the theta phi component of the gauge fields are not constants, but the theta phi dependence is completely specified by the requirement of spherical symmetry. Namely, these must be proportional to sine theta. I'll denote the constants of proportionality by EI over 2 pi. So in this solution, then, V1 and V2 are the sizes of ADS2 times S2. US is the scalar field at the horizon. PI over 4 pi are the radial magnetic fields at the horizon. And EI are the radial electric fields at the horizon. Notice that at this stage, I'm not relating, trying to relate these to the charges of the black hole. Eventually, we'll be doing it. Okay, but at this stage, PI and EI are simply labeling the radial magnetic field and radial electric field at the horizon of the black hole. The key point to note is that the form of the solution is completely determined by the requirement of symmetry up to a few constants. Okay, the only parameters that you have are a few constant parameters. You don't have any undetermined function appearing in the labeling of the solutions. And I have written down these solutions over here on the board, okay, because we will be referring to these solutions from time to time. Now, these solutions have some nice features which follow from the fact that both ADS2 and S2 are individually maximally symmetric spaces. So here I have again written the same metric. And from this metric, we can calculate the Riemann tensors, for example. R alpha beta gamma delta. Alpha beta gamma delta stands for the R and T coordinates. So the only non-zero components are when all the indices are either R or T, R and T, or when all the indices are either theta and phi, there is no mixing. So R alpha beta gamma delta has this specific form. It's proportional. It's constructed out of a metric along the ADS2. R MNPQ, where MNPQ take values over theta and phi, these are constructed out of a metric on S2. Okay, and this, in fact, is precisely the hallmark of the space being maximally symmetric. Besides this, the Fi alpha beta, which means, oh, this should have been not alpha beta, but RT. So yeah, alpha beta is fine. The alpha beta takes value on RT. Okay. So Fi alpha beta are along the directions of R and T. This, you can check, is proportional to the volume form on ADS2. And Fi theta phi is, in fact, proportional to the volume form on S2. And phi is, of course, is constant. And as a consequence of these relations, one can easily check that the covariant derivatives of all these tensors are identically zero. This, of course, is trivial because phi s is a constant, so obviously its covariant derivative is zero. This is true because Fi is proportional to the volume form along ADS2 or S2. And this is true because R nu rho sigma tau is, after all, constructed in terms of the metric, either along ADS2 or along S2. And this means that when we try to analyze the Lagrangian density of the system, or the equations of motion that we derive from the Lagrangian density, only those terms in L contribute which do not involve explicit covariant derivatives of these objects. So when we want to take into account higher derivative corrections, we do have to take into account arbitrary higher powers of F mu nu or R mu nu rho sigma or phi. But any term that involves covariant derivatives of F mu nu or R mu nu rho sigma or phi do not contribute. Why do you say that delta is constant? Okay, as I said, if we want a invariance under the SO2, 1 times SO3 group, then all scalars must be constants. Because it's easy to see from the on S2, right? Because on S2, if you have a scalar field which you want to be invariant under spherical symmetry of the sphere, right, the only configuration is a constant configuration. Right? And the same argument holds also in case of ADS2. So just the symmetry requirement forces all the scalars to go to constants on the horizon. Okay, are there any questions on this? So again, I have written down these explicit expressions for the Riemann tensors here, which you may need to use once in a while. What I'll do next is to give some definitions which are not well motivated at this stage, but we'll see how they are useful. So here again, I have written down the metric for the third time. That's the background, the same background. Now suppose the action is given as an integral of a Lagrangian density. We'll call square root of minus determinant of G times L to be the Lagrangian density. L, as I said, is in principle made of terms involving scalars, gauge fields, gauge field strengths, the Riemann tensor, arbitrary derivatives of those, arbitrary powers of those. But eventually, we only need to keep those terms which do not involve any explicit covariant derivatives of the field strengths or the scalar fields or the Riemann tensor. But we must keep in L terms involving arbitrary powers of the gauge fields, gauge field strengths, arbitrary powers of the Riemann tensor, arbitrary powers of scalar fields, and so on. So we define a function f. Okay, it's a function of the parameters that label this near horizon geometry. So what are they? They are the set of uss, which I'll denote by the vector u. Then they are v1 and v2, which I'll denote by the vector v. And then that is the set of electric fields, the vector E, and the set of magnetic fields, the vector P. So I'll define a function of these four sets of variables simply by integrating square root of minus determinant of G times L over the angular coordinates. Now, this integral, since I'm not integrating over the radial coordinate, one might wonder that whether this integral depends on the radial coordinate. But one can easily see that that is not the case. Why? Because L, the Lagrangian density, is a scalar, and it must be invariant under the SO2,1 times SO3 group, because all the fields are invariant under that symmetric group. And the only scalar configuration that can be invariant under this symmetric group is constant. Right? So when you evaluate the Lagrangian density for this specific background, you are guaranteed to get something that is independent of R and, of course, T. On the other hand, this object, square root of minus determinant of G, as you can see from here, also doesn't involve any explicit factor of R, because this factor of R cancels this factor of 1 over R. So this quantity, even though it looks like it could depend on the radial coordinate R, it actually doesn't depend on the radial coordinate R, and it becomes a simple function of these four variables. And in fact, given any higher derivative action, it's reasonably straightforward to calculate this function, because you don't even have to calculate the Riemann tensor explicitly. They are already given there. So any part of Riemann tensor, gauge field strengths, etc., you can simply put in, and you can calculate what this function small f is. But now I'll do a little bit more. I'll define a set of new variables, which I'll call qi, which are the derivatives of this function f with respect to the ei's. And I'll define a new function capital F, now expressed as a function of the coordinates u, v, q, and p by this expression. And if you just look at it a little bit, you will recognize that f over 2 pi, after you divide this f by this 2 pi, is in fact nothing but the Legendre transform of the function small f with respect to the variable ci. So the variables qi are conjugate to the variable ci. And then this capital F is just a Legendre transform of small f. Okay. Are there any questions at this stage? Now, so far I haven't motivated you why it's important to define this function F. That is going to come in the next transparency when I quote the results. But this is just a definition. And here I have explicitly written down those definitions, because we will be using this again and again in our analysis. In fact, I mean, we'll try to derive the various relations which are given here. OK, So far, these variables, Q and P, have not been interpreted directly as charges, right? We haven't said what Q and P are, okay, in terms of charges. They are simply some parameters that label the electric and magnetic fields. But it will turn out that Q is in fact the electric charge vector of the black hole, and P is the magnetic charge vector. Okay, so the set of parameters QI label the electric charge of the black hole, and the set of parameters PI label the magnetic charge of the black hole. Okay, I'll show explicitly later why that is the case, but that's what will happen. So now I'll quote the main results, which will be useful. And then I'll try to derive these results. Okay, but first, let me state the results, because that will make it clear why this function capital F is an important function. So what are the results? The results are as follows. What we'll show is that if we have an extremal black hole of electric charge Q and magnetic charge P, okay, and here we do make a specific relation, we do state a specific relationship between the parameters Q and P that appeared in the argument of F and the electric and magnetic charges of the black hole. So the claim is that for an extremal black hole with electric charge Q and magnetic charge P, the following results are true. First of all, the values of U, V1, V2, the set of US, the parameters US, V1 and V2 at the horizon, are obtained by extremizing this function capital F with respect to these variables. So you are supposed to extremize capital F with respect to U, V1, and V2, keeping Q and P fixed. Okay, Q being interpreted as the electric charge now, and P being interpreted as the magnetic charge. The second statement is that the near horizon electric field, EI, are given by this relation. It's also determined in terms of this function F, but EI is given by simply the derivative of F with respect to QI, up to this factor of 1 over 2. And the relation that will be most important for analyzing the entropy of the black hole is the statement that the black hole entropy, which I'll denote by SBH, is given by this function F at its extremum. You know, once you have extremized this function F with respect to U, V1, and V2, you simply calculate its value at that extremum, and that is the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole. So these are the results we will try to establish. And again, these three results I have written down here on the board, okay, so that we can come back to it later. Okay, are there any questions? Yeah. No. Yes, so it can involve arbitrary powers of F, it can involve arbitrary covariant derivatives of F mu nu. But as I said, the covariant derivative terms do not matter, but it can involve arbitrary powers of F. Okay, I do not assume that it takes a standard form. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Now, before I show how to derive this relation, let me discuss the significance of this relation. Okay, what physical consequences does this result have? First of all, this makes the calculation of the entropy reasonably straightforward, because all you need to do is to simply take your action, plug in the near horizon geometry, calculate this small function small f, take a Legendre transform, calculate the function capital F, and then that's the entropy, okay, when you extremize it. But there are some physical consequences of this relation. Okay, so let's look at the relations are all given here, okay, which are the, these are the relations that we are going to use now. So you can consider two possibilities. f was a function of the u's and the v's for a fixed q and p. Okay, q and p are the charges, the electric and magnetic charges of the black hole, which of course have been fixed, okay, which are given quantities. So for a given q and p, f is a function of u and v. Okay, and you are supposed to extremize f with respect to u and v. Now, suppose f has no flat directions. If f has no flat direction as a function of u and v, that would mean that the extremum of f is uniquely determined. Okay, or there are at most discrete set of extremum of f, but there is no continuous parameter family of extremum. In this case, you just sit at the extremum of f, and that determines the values of u and v. Right, because you are trying to extremize f with respect to the variables us v1 and v2. If f has no flat direction, then these equations specifies the values of us v1 and v2 completely. Okay. And hence, this specifies the black hole entropy as a function of q and p. We say that this in turn implies that the near horizon solution, and hence the entropy SPH, is independent of the asymptotic values of the moduli fields. Because the near horizon values of u and v are determined simply by extremizing this function f, which of course doesn't know anything about the asymptotic values of the moduli fields. This feature we also saw in Samir Mathur's talk in some specific examples, and he discussed the importance of this observation, why we want the entropy to be independent of the asymptotic values of the moduli fields, because entropy is something that counts the number of states, and we do not want it to vary continuously as you vary the asymptotic moduli. Now suppose this is not true. Suppose f has some flat directions. If f has flat directions, what does that mean? That means that these equations that I have written down here, okay, that the equation that extremizes f, these equations do not determine all the parameters u and v's completely. And hence, these parameters could depend on the asymptotic values of the moduli fields. Okay? So if f has some flat direction, then where exactly along that flat direction you are sitting may depend on what the asymptotic values of the moduli fields were. But because f is flat in these directions, the value of f along this flat direction still doesn't depend on those asymptotic values of the moduli fields. So even though the near horizon geometry may depend on the asymptotic values of the moduli fields, the black hole entropy still doesn't depend on these asymptotic moduli. And what is important here is that the black hole entropy is given by the same function f whose extremization determines the near horizon geometry, okay, and the near horizon values of the fields. This mechanism is a generalization of the attractor mechanism, which were first discussed by Ferrara, Kalosh, and Strominger. And this was discussed, in fact, in the context of supersymmetric theories with lowest derivative terms. And there had been some progress in understanding this in supersymmetric theories when you include a certain set of higher derivative terms. But what we see from this analysis is that this is quite a general result, that the entropy of an extremal black hole, in fact, doesn't depend on the asymptotic values of the moduli fields, even if the theory has no supersymmetry. Okay? And irrespective of whether the theory has higher curvature terms or not. Okay, are there any questions? Now let me again emphasize that in deriving these relations, we do not require the theory or the solution to be supersymmetric. And we do not require any spatial structure of the higher derivative terms except general coordinate invariance and gauge invariance. We'll see explicitly how we go about deriving these relations. And the other feature which is important is that the single entropy function, the F you can call the entropy function because its value at the extremum is the entropy. The single entropy function F determines not only the near horizon values of the scalar fields, but also the sizes of ADS2 and S2. Okay, so it not only determines the values of the scalar fields, but also the geometry. It determines the gauge field strengths, and it determines the entropy. And as I have already said, similar results also hold in higher dimensions for near horizon geometry ADS2 times SD minus 2. Are there any questions? Not right now, no. Okay, because what was important in this analysis, as you will see, is that the solution is parameterized by just constants. Okay, when you have non-spherical black holes, in general, there can be functions and not constants. Okay, so those are harder to deal with. Okay, so let me then begin by indicating how these results are derived. So for that, let's go back to the definition of the function small f. The function small f was given by the angular integral of square root of minus determinant of g times L, okay, L being the Lagrangian density. And as I've already said, that this quantity is in fact independent of the radial coordinate r. Okay, so if you want to derive the action, it's simply the integral over the radial coordinate of this quantity. Now, when you derive the equations of motion from the action, we require the action to be symmetric, to be the first order variation of the action to vanish along any direction of deformation. Okay, so given a set of field variables, you can deform it in any direction, and you want the first order variation to be zero. That's the equation of motion. In particular, we can require that the action is stationary along the directions of deformation of v1, v2, and e-ways. Okay, so simply change v1 to v1 plus delta v1, or v2 to v2 plus delta v2, or e-ways to e-ways plus delta e-ways, and the variation of the action should vanish to first order in these variables. This, in turn, leads to this set of equations, okay, namely that the variation, the first derivative of the function f with respect to u, v1 and v2, must vanish. Now, one might think that this is only a very small set of constraints among many that you'll get from equations of motion. However, because of the SO2,1 times SO3 invariance of the background, and because of the fact that this set of parameters, u, v1, v2, okay, in fact characterize the most general background consistent with this symmetry, one can show that these equations are not only necessary, but also sufficient to guarantee that the metric and the scalar field equations are satisfied. Okay, so once you have satisfied these equations, the background automatically satisfies the full set of metric and scalar field equations. So what we need to do now is to analyze the equations of motion for the gauge fields. Okay, because those are the equations of motion which are still left over. Okay, are there any questions? Well, that's the postulate, right? That the extremal black holes have this invariance. Okay, as I said, ADS2 times S2 is invariant under SO2,1 times SO3. And all the known extremal black holes, including the ones which have been constructed in hard derivative theories of gravity, have this symmetry. Right? So that's the postulate for what the extremal black holes would look like. Okay? But given that postulate, now one can ask, can you find a consistent solution of these equations of motion in this hard derivative gravity, right? It might have turned out that the higher derivative gravity doesn't admit this solution. That is, as you will see, that is not the case in general. So you do have a candidate for near horizon geometry, which is a perfectly good solution of the full set of equations of motion. And we'll call that a black hole to be an extremal black hole if the black hole geometry matches onto this solution near the horizon. Right? That will be the definition of the extremal black hole. So let me now turn to the non-trivial part of the gauge field equations and the Bianchi identities. So the non-trivial part of the gauge field equation comes from variation of the action with respect to the time component, the t component of AI. And if we take into account the radial symmetry, in fact, this equation doesn't even require using the ADS2 times S2 geometry, any spherically symmetric field configuration, any spherically symmetric solution, any spherically symmetric configuration has an equation of motion which is given by this. And that's in fact important. I have not used the fact that this, that the near horizon geometry is ADS2 times S2. Okay, so this equation holds for the full black hole background, not just near the horizon. And the non-trivial part of the Bianchi identity in this case takes this form. Okay, so the radial derivative of theta phi component of A phi is 0. So what this tells us is that this quantity, the delta S delta Fi RT, should be a constant independent of the radius. Similarly, this tells us that Fi theta phi should be a constant independent of the radius. Now, what is the value of this constant? We can evaluate these constants by looking at r equal to infinity, the asymptotic region of the black hole, because it's the same constant. If we go to the asymptotic region of the black hole, then this integral, then in fact, the only part of S that contributes is the usual f mu nu term. All the higher derivative terms drop out. So in the asymptotic region, this quantity is simply the radial electric field. And if you do an angular integral of this, that's the electric charge by definition. Similarly, in the asymptotic region, this quantity is just a radial magnetic field. And if you do an integral of this over the angular coordinates, you get the magnetic charge. So this way we can determine the constants of integration to be proportional to the electric and magnetic charges by working at r equal to infinity. But now we can also evaluate this constant by working at r equal to the horizon. So if you evaluate the same thing on the horizon, what you get for this quantity after you do the angular integral is simply del f del ei. Okay, not a surprise, because f, after all, is the angular integral. As you can see from here, f is nothing but the angular integral of Lagrangian density. So the variation of the action with respect to fi rt, which is ei at the horizon, is simply del f del ei. So that gives us an equation, del f del ei equal to qi. And similarly, the integral of this should be the magnetic charge. And that tells us that integral d theta d phi, fi theta phi, is a magnetic charge pi. And this, in fact, is already anticipated when each parameterize fi theta phi as pi sine theta over 4 pi, because this made it, once you put fi theta phi equal to pi sine theta over 4 pi, we see that this integral is indeed pi. And this equation tells us that pi is to be interpreted as a magnetic charge of the black hole. So this then establishes the relationship between the parameters labeling the gauge fields near the horizon to the electric and magnetic charges carried by the black hole. Okay, are there any questions? Yeah. No. No, that's the point. That this symmetry is a symmetry of the near horizon geometry. I mean, it's exactly similar to what happens in the extreme Reisner Nordstrom solution, right? Certainly, the solution is not ADS2 times S2 far away in the asymptotic region. But once you go near horizon, then the geometry becomes ADS2 times S2. right? So the ADS, this symmetry exists only on the near horizon geometry. Now you can, of course, that geometry is a complete geometry by itself, right? You can, that is a complete solution of the equations of motion. But you have to deform the geometry by a small perturbation, so that as you go to large and large art, then for sufficiently large art, you reach the black hole solution. But for small art, that perturbation dies away, and you reach the ADS 2 times S2 configuration. It's exactly like what happens in extreme Reisner-Nordström. Because if this geometry had been the full geometry, then you will not get an asymptotically flat space. Right? You want this black hole in an asymptotically flat Minkowski space. So let me now collect all the equations that we got. And here are they. So for given Q and P, the equations that determine the background are here. These are the equations of motion for the scalars, the metric components. And here is the equation of motion. Here is what comes out of the gauge field equations of motion, del F del E I equal to QI. And the additional thing we learned is that this parameter PI has the interpretation of the magnetic charge. QI has the interpretation of electric charge. Now recall the definition of the function capital F. Capital F up to this factor of 2 pi is simply the Legendre transform of the function small f. And now it's easy to check. It's in fact a simple consequence of the properties of Legendre transform that these set of equations which are written in terms of small f, okay, and the derivatives are to be carried out by taking u, v, and e as independent variables are equivalent to these set of equations in terms of the function capital F. And here, the derivatives, the partial derivatives that appear here, are to be carried out by taking u, v, and q as independent variables. Okay, so these set of equations are exactly equivalent to these set of equations. And it's precisely these equations which appear in this, in here. So what we have then succeeded in doing is to establish the equations 1 and 2. Okay, these are the two results which I had promised we'll derive. And we see that these results simply follow as a consequence of the equations of motion. Okay. So now we'll have to go turn to the non-trivial part of the result, namely that this function f also determines the Bekenstein fucking entropy. Okay, this will be the next goal. Are there any other questions? To be convex? Yeah, in a sense, otherwise it may have more than one solution, right? Which presumably means that these attractor equations, right, for a given electric and magnetic charge, there will be more than one point in the moduli space which solves the equations. Okay. And then, depending on what the asymptotic values of the moduli are, in one domain you may get attracted to one fixed point. In another domain you can get attracted to another fixed point. Right? So it depends on whether the function, these equations have unique solution or not. Okay, so the same ambiguity that appears in the Legendre transform will also appear here. And that's simply a statement of the near horizon geometry being having some discrete ambiguity if there are more than one solution. Okay, now before I go on to derive the relationship between the black hole entropy and F, let me just put up another transparency, which is, it doesn't have any new identity, but it's just a different way of writing the same equation that I have derived here, which sometimes is useful for practical calculation, okay, which does not require us to take the Legendre transform at the beginning, okay, because this way of setting up the calculation requires that we construct this function capital F by taking the Legendre transform first and then writing down these equations. But suppose the function small f is so complicated that it's difficult to solve these equations directly. Okay, it's difficult to solve these equations for to express E in terms of Q. So just for practical use, one can also set up the calculation in a slightly different way. And that is to define this capital, the function capital F, in this way. That we now take the capital F, not only a function of U, V, Q, and P, but also a function of E. And we define it by simply subtracting small f from EI, QI, and then multiplying the whole thing by 2 pi. So now this function capital F is a function of 5 sets of variables. Okay, instead of the 4 sets of variables that we had earlier, the way we define it, of course, is the same. Okay, that only difference is what we take as the independent variables. And we now postulate no relationship between the U and E and Q to begin with. And now the equations that appeared there are exactly equivalent to the following set of equations. They are equivalent to extremizing F with respect to the variables U, the variables V1, V2, and the variable CI. Because what happens is that once you extremize F with respect to EI, that automatically generates the required relation between Q and E. And then, of course, these equations will become exactly equivalent to the equations that we have here. And once you have solved this, then you evaluate the black hole entropy to y as F at the extremum. Okay, so this is just something which is useful for practical computation often. And in our actual calculation, if we do work out examples, we'll use this method sometimes. So now we come to the hard part, which is to calculate the black hole entropy. And here, we have to take into account the fact that because we are dealing with a theory with hard derivative terms, we can no longer identify the entropy as the area of the event horizon. In fact, there is a general formula for the entropy, which has been written down for theories with hard derivative interactions. And this formula was derived by various people who are mentioned here. Since, okay, the formula is known for a general black hole, but our interest is in spherically symmetric black holes, so we'll simplify the formula. We'll write down a simplified version of the formula that is valid for spherically symmetric black holes, and that's given here. So what does it say? Okay, it's there's a factor of minus 8 pi multiplying the integral over the horizon, which in our case is just the S2, of a quantity which I'll explain in a few minutes, delta S, delta R, RT, RT, times square root of minus GRR, GTT. These are just the metric components. Now, what is this object? Okay, this curly S, of course, is the action. This object, okay, the way we calculate this object, so this object literally is the functional derivative of the action with respect to the components of the Riemann tensor. But the Riemann tensor, of course, is not independent variable, right? Typically, Riemann tensor you think of as something derived from a metric. So what does one mean by taking the functional derivative of the action with respect to the Riemann tensor? So the prescription is the following, that we express the action S in terms of symmetrized covariant derivatives of various fields. And then after we have done that, in the final expression for the action, we simply treat R, mu, nu, rho, sigma as variables which are independent of the metric. And then calculate the variation of the action with respect to R, mu, nu, rho, sigma. Okay, that's what defines what this functional derivative is. In particular, it's a simple exercise to see that if we have the usual Einstein-Hilbert action, okay, where the way the Riemann tensor enters is through the Ricci scalar, just square root of minus determinant of G times R, then this derivative, this functional derivative, is just given by some components of the RR component of the metric times the TT component of the metric, and the whole this formula reduces to the usual area law. Okay, I'll not go through the calculation in detail, but it's easy to check that this formula reduces to the standard area formula when this action is as Einstein-Hilbert action. But this is the more general formula. OK, are there any questions? Yeah, that is true. In fact, this is like the free energy. Okay, but free energy in what ensemble, right? I mean, you have to define properly. So this is, I mean, this you can define, or e to the small f is like the black hole partition function in a specific ensemble, right, where you sum over all charges. Okay, and you introduce a chemical potential conjugate to those charges. In fact, this way, one can also make connection with the work of Oguri, Pfaff, and Strominger. And if I have some time, I'll maybe talk about it tomorrow. OK. So let me display this formula again. So here is the formula for the black hole entropy again. And now we use the fact that the covariant derivatives of all field strengths, okay, covariant derivatives of r mu nu, rho sigma, f mu nu, phi, everything vanishes. Okay. And so the only part of S which is relevant for this calculation, okay, is the part that involves terms without any covariant derivatives. Okay, so you have to include higher derivative corrections, but only those which correspond to higher powers of the Riemann tensor or higher powers of gauge field strengths, etc. But not powers of covariant derivatives of the Riemann tensor or covariant derivatives of the gauge field strengths. Okay? Because those evaluated on this background give you zero. So this means that in calculating the action, we can ignore all terms in the Lagrangian density which involve covariant derivatives of phi s, a phi mu nu, and r mu nu, rho sigma. And you can simplify this formula. The functional derivative, which appears here, can now be rewritten as an ordinary derivative of the Lagrangian density with respect to RT, RT. And again, in computing this ordinary derivative, we have to treat the components of the Riemann tensor as independent of the components of the metric. Okay, that's just a prescription. Okay, it doesn't mean that they are really independent, but in calculating this derivative, okay, the expression which appears in the entropy formula has to be calculated by pretending as if the components of the Riemann tensor are independent of the components of the matrix. Okay, are there any questions? Okay, so this formula, since I'll be using it, okay, I have written down here. Okay, and we'll refer to this formula from time to time. So our goal then is to calculate the right hand side. Okay? And eventual goal is to relate it to this function capital F that we define. Okay? But you see that this right hand side contains some derivative of the Lagrangian density with respect to Riemann tensor. Right? So somehow we have to get rid of that, because the definition of capital F or definition of small f simply involved integral of the Lagrangian density. Right? It didn't have any derivative with respect to Riemann tensor. So you have to play some tricks to get rid of this derivative. And that's what we'll do now. OK. So now let me go through these things step by step. Okay, maybe I'll do this part first. So first, we define a new Lagrangian density, which I'll call L lambda, okay, labeled by this parameter lambda. Okay. And it's defined to be exactly the same as the original Lagrangian density, except that every power of R alpha beta gamma delta, and let me remind you that this alpha beta gamma delta run over R and T indices. Okay, so these are the ADS2 coordinates, that every factor of R alpha beta gamma delta in L is multiplied by a factor of lambda. So this is my definition of L lambda. And we define f lambda as a function of u, v, e, and p as simply the integral of L lambda multiplied by square root of minus determinant of g over the angular coordinates, okay, and evaluated on the near horizon geometry. Okay. That's why it's a function of these coordinates u, v, e, and p. So clearly, if you set lambda equal to 1, then this function is simply f, right, the original function f, which you should keep in mind. But we have introduced this lambda by multiplying each factor of r alpha, beta, gamma, delta by lambda. Is this definition clear? Now let's calculate lambda del del lambda of f lambda. Since every power of lambda is accompanied by a power of r alpha, beta, gamma, delta, we know that lambda del del lambda of f lambda will be simply del L lambda del r alpha, beta, gamma, delta times r alpha, beta, gamma, delta. Okay? That's the property of homogeneous functions. However, this sum over alpha, beta, gamma, delta will run over four possible values, all of which are equal to each other. Because alpha, beta, gamma, delta can be rt, rt, or tr, rt, tr, tr, rt, tr, right? There are four possible combinations for which this is non-zero. And so there will be four terms in this sum which will be identical, and that's why it is factor of four terms. Okay, so maybe I should have written down that intermediate step, that lambda del del lambda is the same as r alpha beta gamma delta del del r alpha beta gamma delta. And the factor of four comes because if you just write, take rt rt, okay, then that's one term, but then there is a tr tr, that's another term, tr rt is another term, so there are four terms altogether, and that gives the factor of four. Okay. Now, for our background, it's easy to verify, in fact, from those relations over there. Okay, it's all here. That this component, RT, RT component of capital R, is in fact equal to square root of minus GRR times GTT. So let's put that in. And what do we get? Once we put this equal to square root of minus GRR times GTT, we see that the right-hand side is nothing but the right-hand side of this equation. Right? The expression for S, the black hole entropy. So we learn that the black hole entropy is given by minus 2 pi times del F lambda del lambda at lambda equal to 1. Okay, this 8, here is a minus 8 pi, but a factor of 4 came out. So it should be multiplied by minus 2 pi. Is this logic clear? So what you have succeeded in converting the derivative with respect to r mu nu rho sigma to derivative with respect to lambda. Okay, but still we have what to do, because now we have to transfer the derivative over lambda to derivative over other objects, because we didn't have any lambda in our definition of capital F. So this will be our next task. Okay, so what we'll do now is to try to write del F lambda del lambda in terms of derivatives of F lambda with respect to V1 and EI. And we'll see how that is done. Okay, are there any questions on this? And the way we'll do this is by using the general coordinate invariance of our Lagrangian. Okay, we said that we can include arbitrary higher derivative terms, but each term is general coordinate invariant by itself. And that already puts some constraint on what kind of term can accompany what kind of term. For example, let's take a factor of RT-RT component of the Riemann tensor. By general covariance, these lower R's have to be contracted with some upper R's. Right? And the only upper R's with which it can be contracted is the metric component. Right? Because the gauge field, the field strengths, FIRT also has lower component R, and T. So the combination that appears with RRTRT is this multiplied by GRR times GTT, and of course lambda, because every factor of R alpha beta gamma delta comes with a lambda. And this combination you can easily check that it's nothing but lambda times V1 inverse. Okay, V1, let me remind you, was the size related to the size of ATS2. Similarly, we can look at the RT component of the gauge field strength. Every power of R must be contracted with an uppercase R, with an R in the contravariant R. And that can only come from the metric. In fact, a single power requires only a square root of minus GRR. And a single power of T requires a square root of GTT. So every factor of FIRT must come in this combination. And that is EI times V1 inverse. Okay, because this combination is nothing but V1 inverse. These objects, the theta phi component of either the Riemann tensor or the gauge field strength or the scalar fields, of course, do not have any accompanying factor of V1. Right? These have accompanying factor of metric along S2, which are controlled by the size of S2, which is V2. But these do not have any factor of V1. And here is an important point, that if we had in the action other terms involving covariant derivatives of fields, then those covariant derivatives also had to be contracted with something. Right? So you'll need more powers of G mu nu with upper mu nu index to contract with the covariant derivatives. But we have already argued that we do not have any covariant derivative terms. All the effect of all the covariant derivative terms can be ignored, okay, because they don't contribute either to the equation of motion or to the entropy. So because there are no covariant derivatives contracting with the metric, there cannot be any other factor of the metric in the action except those accompanying the components of the Riemann tensor and the components of the gauge field strength. The only other source of the dependence on the metric component V1 is from the overall multiplicative factor of square root of minus determinant of G, which you have to put in explicitly. And this gives a general form of this function F lambda. So F lambda is a function of UV. To begin with, it was a function of several variables, or variable lambda, as well as UV, E, and P. But what we see is that this has a structure, that this has a factor of V1 first, coming from the square root of minus determinant of G. And then a function of U, V, 2, P, okay, these do not come with any factor of V1 accompanying them. Then the lambda must be accompanied by V1 inverse, as you can see from here. And each factor of EI is accompanied by a function of by V1 inverse, as you can see from here. So this F lambda has this structure for some function G. Okay, this relation follows simply from the general coordinate invariance of the action. Is this point clear? Yeah. Oh, because the covariant derivative of the metric, of course, is identically zero. Right? So, yeah, so the point is the covariant derivatives of anything that you can construct in this are all zero. Okay, are there any other questions? So let's now see what this relation gives us. Okay, so here I have written the same relation again. Now, if you stare at it, what it says is that this function f lambda is a homogeneous function of degree 1 in v1, lambda, and ei. In other words, if you just scale v1, lambda, and ei by the same amount, the function simply gets multiplied by that constant. And this gives rise to the simple identity, which is given here. Right? It's a homogeneous function of degree 1 of v1, lambda, and ei. And hence, it must satisfy an identity of this form. Now, let's set lambda equal to 1 in this. Right? So here, you'll get lambda del f lambda del lambda at lambda equal to 1. In these, you can just set lambda equal to 1 because these are derivatives with respect to the other variables. So f lambda can be replaced by f, right, in these relations. But what is del f del v1? Del f del v1 is 0 at the extremum. Right, because this is one of the equations of motion. So we say that the black hole entropy, which we had earlier derived to be this object over here, can now be rewritten using this equation. This term vanishes. So there is a term ei del f del ei. Okay, at lambda equal to 1, f lambda is the same as f, so which is here. And then there is minus f. Okay, again, at lambda equal to 1, f lambda is simply f. So the expression for the black hole entropy, which involved derivative of f lambda with respect to lambda, now has been rewritten as a derivative of f with respect to ei. And that, in fact, is nothing but the function capital F that we have defined. So this then is the desired result, which tells us, which is given here, okay, that the black hole entropy is given by this function f. Okay, are there any questions? The extremization with respect to v1 over v2 becomes 0, yes? It becomes 0 meaning that there is the solution gives you v1 equal to 0 or v2 equal to 0. Exactly, yeah. So that would mean that there is really no such solution, right? If you find that the geometry is becoming singular, and we will see examples of this, right, then we just conclude that such a black hole solution doesn't exist. Right, and you cannot construct a black hole with those charges which have a near horizon geometry which has this ADS2 times S2 form. Right, and we'll see an example of this in the next lecture, okay, where the solution doesn't exist. Okay, so next time we are going to use this to analyze the entropy of black holes in the presence of higher derivative terms. But just to make sure that all our abstract arguments are not completely false, what I'll do now is to try to apply this to calculate the entropy of the familiar Reisner-Nordstrom black hole. Okay, and see what answer we get. So let's just take normal Einstein-Maxwell theory in d equal to 4 and apply this formalism to calculate the entropy of the black hole and find a near horizon geometry of the black hole. So the Lagrangian density is given here, okay, a single gauge field. Now let's consider an extremal black hole solution with near horizon geometry of precisely the form that I have given you earlier. The metric is given by this. The electric field is E. The magnetic field is B. okay, up to this factors of sine theta. So we calculate f. Okay, what is f? F is this integral d theta d phi times the Lagrangian density. So the square root of minus determinant of g, as you can see from here, gives you a factor of v1, v2. Right? And sine theta, that integral sine theta d theta d phi, well, I probably forgot, there's a factor of 4 pi in front, okay, which I have forgotten. Okay, so inside we have 1 over 16 pi gn, and this r you can calculate, okay, with those form, the formula that I have given there, and you find that this is just minus 2 over v1 plus 2 over v2. And then this quantity is the electric field square minus magnetic field square, and that's here. So this is our f. Okay. Here I have the 4 pi factor correctly. So here is the same f, so with the 4 pi factor corrected. What is capital F? Okay, now I'm using the formalism that I described, okay, which is useful for practical utility. Namely, I'll treat capital F as a function of E as well as Q. So capital F is now a function of these 5 variables, 2 pi times Q E minus F. And here it is. Okay, all I have done is that I have taken this V1, V2, and the 4 pi V1, V2 factor, and taken it inside. We have multiplied it out. And now I'm supposed to solve these equations. I'm supposed to extremize capital F with respect to E, V1, V2. There's no scalar field in this problem. So let's do that. Okay, we can extremize this, and we get a nice solution, which is here. We put it back in the expression for F, because the black hole entropy is just F evaluated at this extremum. And you can easily verify that when you do that, you get 1 fourth Q square plus P square. And in the normalization that I have used, this is in fact precisely the entropy of the extremal rise in the Nordstrom black hole. In fact, we can also check that this entropy is the same as the area of the event horizon divided by 4 times g Newton. How? What is the area of the event horizon? Area of the event horizon, in fact, is just 4 pi times v2. Right? V2 is the size of S2. So it's 4 pi times this. Okay? Gn times square, q square plus p square. And now you divide it by 4 times the Newton's constant, you get back this. Right? It is, of course, not a surprise, because for the normal Maxwell-Einstein theory, this is what we expect. But this calculation should also make it clear that it's extremely easy in this formalism to incorporate the effect of higher derivative terms, right? Because suppose we add a curvature square term to the action, and you want to calculate the entropy of the black hole. What would you do? You would go back to the previous formula. You'd go back here and just add some curvature square term or whatever you want to add, some higher powers of the gauge field strength maybe. You just evaluate those terms for this near horizon geometry, which is given here, and plug it in. And all that will do is to give some additional contribution to the small f, okay, which you can easily evaluate. And given that, we define the capital F exactly in the same fashion. Okay, define capital F by the same relation as given here, and play this game. Okay, just solve these equations and put it back and calculate the value of F. So as I said, next time we'll try to do this in more detail, and perhaps do I have any more time, or am I out of time? Okay, the other thing I wanted to discuss is the generalization to higher dimension, but maybe I'll postpone it till next time. Okay, before I start next time, I'll discuss briefly how we generalize this to higher dimensional spherical symmetric black holes. And then I'll make specific connection to string theory and how these are useful in calculating, say, the degeneracy, the entropy that describes elementary string states. So I'll stop here. Thank you.
of properties of harm.